This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Janice. Thanks for your support, Janice. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And certain levels of support entitle you to pick a property for me to live tweet, which, just a reminder, I will be doing on the weekend of October 26th with an Amy Fisher TV movie trifecta, a.k.a. Butterfwocalypse, chosen by Scott. Those live tweets are open to everyone, of course. Just follow the podcast on Twitter at Blotter Presents for more information and to watch along. And now, on with the show.
So it makes me sad that she's far away.
How sad are you?
Pretty sad. She watched over me. She took good care of me. She always, you know, looked out for me and helped me be a good person. Done? Okay, then you have to say cut.
Cut.
That autumn, she's a pro. The war on drugs causes its customary collateral damage, and Rudy Valdez's deeply personal account of his sister's mandatory sentencing ordeal in HBO's The Sentence. And a This American Life episode from 1999 called Sentencing shows us how little has changed. Insert good time pun here. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 72. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, devoted to the principle that crime is bad, but some of the stories about crime can be really good. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and joining us as a condition of his parole is Toby Ball. Hello, Toby.
Hey, Sarah.
Today we are talking about the latest documentary from HBO Studios, which will have aired as you're listening to this 2 nights ago. Should be available now on HBO's Go and Now, and in probably constant reruns. That's our Most Wanted section. The film is called The Sentence, and here is the case file from K. Austin Collins' review for VanityFair.com. Cindy Shank, mother of three, is sent to prison. She has an old boyfriend to thank for that, Alex, who became a drug dealer during their time together and who stored guns and drug paraphernalia in his home. When Alex was killed, the police arrived at his house and found Cindy, who refused to take a plea. She was not involved in Alex's drug business or in his murder. Though she was mercifully let off the hook, the police came knocking again some years later, after Cindy had gotten married, had kids, and bettered herself. This time, the charge is conspiracy, and Cindy cannot escape. She is sentenced to 15 years in prison. The film is made by her, by Cindy's younger brother, Rudy, who has some, he's done camera work for documentary shows like Brick City. And this put me in mind in the, you know, personal subjective take on this one case and the emotion that he did not feel obligated to divorce himself from. Reminded me of Strong Island, which was nominated for a documentary Oscar last year. Toby, did you see Strong Island?
I don't know anything about it.
I'd be interested to hear your take on it. I think that this is this is a good way to do a documentary. Like, you know, I love documentaries, and I don't think there's necessarily a bad way to do it. And I think that telling your family story in this way and sort of letting yourself be in it and be part of the film can be good and has its place. And this filmmaker is, to the extent that he's in the film, extremely likable. He's obviously good with his nieces, and he has a little sort of self-aware bit at one point where he talks about the fact that being behind the camera for this project can sort of lets him hide and escape from the situation.
Right.
On the other hand, There were some aspects of the structuring of this documentary that frustrated me a little bit. Toby, you, I think, just finished watching it moments ago as we're recording this. What did you think about it overall?
Overall, I liked it a lot, and it's not the kind of thing that I usually like, because it is, I mean, it's a tearjerker. I mean, there's no question about it.
For sure.
But I think it's really well done, and it's good that he's a member of the family, I think, because otherwise I think it would have felt maybe too intrusive. But the fact that he is a member of the family, in my mind made it seem okay. There are a couple scenes where there's a scene where a sister just can't talk about it and kind of breaks down, and he puts the camera down, but keeps the audio going, which was, you know, the only time that it felt like a little uncomfortable. But he really, I mean, he gets the full, I guess, sort of range of the impact of this woman being put away for 9 years.
Yeah, he really does. And the fact that he's the youngest in the family, of the siblings by far, it sort of is an interesting perspective as well.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The only thing I found a little bit frustrating was that it was clear, based on chyrons and things that he was saying on camera, that he was very involved in the appeals process for Cindy and for like filing for clemency and commutations and sort of being in constant contact with the Department of Corrections and so on and so forth regarding her case. And, you know, I won't reveal the ending. It's a happy one, I guess, bittersweet. But I felt like that should have been either foregrounded more or just maybe not mentioned, or mentioned with a single chyron, because I felt like that part of it was, you know, like, it's not irrelevant, obviously. But I also felt like at times he felt like he was backtracking to kind of an automatic, like, this is how documentaries about this topic are structured, and this is the information they include, and I'm going to include a mention of this. But if you're gonna talk about the actual process of trying to get someone who was sentenced in this draconian fashion out, then you need to talk about it.
Right. I guess the only thing I thought about that, and I basically agree with you, is that I thought it just kind of hinted at, you know, this process of kind of getting your hopes up and then getting them dashed, and getting your hopes up and then getting them dashed, and then, you know, two thirds of the way through it or halfway through it or whatever, you know, especially, what's her name? Who's Cindy?
Cindy.
Yeah. You can tell that she's just like, I just
that
can't.
Her last name is Shank. I just realized. Right. It's really kind of a bitter, bitter irony.
Yeah.
Yikes.
There's a point at which she's just like, I can't do the roller coaster. I mean, she doesn't put it in those words, but you can tell that she's sort of fatigued from these moments of getting her hopes up, only to have things not come through. I don't want to jump ahead of what we're going to be talking about, but there's a lot of, she comes off, even though you only see her on camera a tiny bit, she comes off as a pretty interesting character, I thought.
Yeah. And, very relatable, I thought. In clip two, she's just talking about her late boyfriend, Alex, who got her sort of posthumously into this mess. So let's have a listen to that.
When I first initially started dating Alex, he wasn't doing these drug dealings. It started while we were already dating. I was in love with him, and I stayed because I had this hope that he was going to come back to this guy that I knew, and he just never did, and it just grew out of control. And then he was murdered.
When the police got there, they saw guns, drugs, money. The state threatened to charge her right away with all of these crimes.
That just felt very relatable to me, that she's, you know, 18, 20 years old, and here's this guy, and he's very charismatic, and he's getting in trouble, and you love him, and you feel like, oh, well, he'll turn this around. He'll come away from this. And also, it has nothing to do with me.
Right.
So, I mean, they're, you know, like, having dated my share of, like, shit bricks. No, you know, no, nobody felonious, but I found that very relatable, that she's like, you know, you love the wrong guy, like, big time. And then from beyond the grave, he gets her locked up. Like, 6 years went by. She married this guy. She had three little kids. Like, one of her kids was a newborn.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, there's so many things going on with that. One of which is this idea that she was obligated to turn him in, and like the failure to do so was tantamount to being directly involved. So that, it's a strange sort of legal a thing that you have to bear, is if your significant other is doing something illegal, that if you don't snitch on him, that then you are legally responsible for the exact same thing that he's doing. Seems a little iffy to me, but I think that's more for the second half of this.
Well, yeah. And the fact that they, you know, that part of the statute is clearly to create leverage so that snitching will be, I guess, easier to induce.
Right.
The other thing that's not necessarily for her
to snitch on it is dead. You know, I mean, it's just, and that was a question I had that they don't bring up at all is why after this period of time do they come and get her? Like, unless I missed it.
Yeah, I don't really understand. I don't really understand that either. And they didn't really get into that. And the other thing I don't really get is, and you know, you hear this in the current season of Serial, and we'll hear it in our next segment, and you see it if you're, you know, reading along with Courtroom 302, which is the thing that sort of inspired Serial to take the shape it's taking in the third season. This, like, overcharging of people in the hopes that they can offer, well, yeah, that seems like a lot of time. You just have to tell us what you know. But then if they don't know anything, it's like, why continue? Like, she wouldn't take a plea because she had nothing to offer you.
Right.
So, and she wasn't going to make shit up. So once that's evident, why don't you just admit that bluff was called not in your favor, and I don't know, give her some community service, like, especially after 6 years, like, fuck's sake, she has little children.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was kind of like what I
was that a lesson to.
What I walked away thinking about is, you know, if you're trying to look at sort of the bigger picture and how Cindy fits into it, you know, is society better served by putting her away for that period of time because she won't or has no ability to snitch about somebody else, versus letting her, and she's clearly not, well, I mean, I say clearly, as far as you can tell from the documentary, she's no longer involved in anything related to drugs. I mean, she's married to this guy, and she's got three kids, and it seems like she's living a pretty, you know, average blue collar existence. So what is the benefit of putting her away? I mean, it just seems so clearly the wrong choice to make. That,
well, and yeah, you also have to wonder how much of law enforcement's motivation here, whether they're conscious of it or not, is motivated by the fact that this is a Latinx woman.
Yeah.
the filmmaker does not make this explicit, and no one in the family really makes it explicit, but you have to wonder if it wasn't just some, like, I don't know, some politician trying to look like he's cracking down on gangs in Lansing, Michigan. Like, okay, how'd that work? You good now that Cindy's locked up?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where it's hard to imagine, a married white woman, who is making good money or whatever, like the same thing happening to her if the circumstances, like, she had a former boyfriend who was dealing drugs. I mean, I think that's you can take it a bunch of steps out further about, like, the differences in drug prosecutions of minorities versus white people, and what the sentencing guidelines are for crack versus powder cocaine and all this stuff.
Oh yeah. We'll get into that.
You know, there's a big finger on the balance.
Yeah, for sure. And I just don't think it's a coincidence that they threw the entire book at her. And when they missed 6 years later, they threw it again. And the other thing that the film does pretty well, but I almost wish that there were more formal structure to this, is that Valdez starts filming in, like, 2010, right up to last year. So you're seeing her kids grow up, and they, like, I wish he'd been a little more consistent in, like, when exactly he's filming, that they would say the same thing every time. I'll get into her relationship with her husband in a second, but this clip is definitely designed to break your heart, and it will. Here's her oldest daughter, Autumn, in clip 3.
Does mommy talk about how long she's going to be there?
She does sometimes, not too often.
What does she say?
She says that it's going to be, like, probably when I'm 12, 13 years old, that will happen. She'll come home. She thinks that. And I'm only 6 right now. So it won't be that early. It will be later on.
I mean, they're all adorable. And yeah. I just love, like, that just reminded me of my niece and how kids that age love to, like, let you know what
right.
they know.
Exactly.
Like, they love to have, like, a little class. You ask them a question and they're like, well, and it was adorable and made me miss my niece and also so sad for this whole family.
See, what was it, for me, like, my daughter is 13, which is what Autumn is at the end. And then you're just doing the math and it's like, you know, the idea that I would have missed out from when she was 4 years old until now is, you know, especially for some bullshit like Cindy got put away for, it's inexcusable. But I think, you know, we talk about this on Crime Writer sometimes, but it's, you know, I think there's some tension in between, like, creating a system that can work for, you know, just this, like, incredible number of cases and, you know, sort of being able to make calls on an individual basis that allows you to kind of step away from the protocols that the system has set up. And I think in this situation, it's like you have a system with the way that you prosecute drug crimes, which is completely messed up. And then through laws, and again, we'll talk about this more in the second half, you've made it so that there isn't that opportunity to take a broader look and say, you know, are we best served by locking this person up? It's like, no, you have to, this is the guideline that you have to follow. You don't have, you can't make the decision, you know?
Yeah. They have no discretion.
Right.
And on top of that, once you are in the correction system, whether it's in your state or at the federal level, and I think this is particularly, this is a particular problem for incarcerated women because there are fewer of them and the systems that are in place are more, not flexible, but like there's just more changeability in their situations. And over the course of the documentary, Cindy is transferred to various prisons. Like the first one is in Pekin, Illinois. Is that where it is?
Somewhere in the Midwest, not too far from where they are.
Yeah, it's not like close. It's still half a day's drive, but at least it's half a day's drive. And then they just like closed that facility and sent her to Florida. And then she gets moved again to Kentucky eventually, which is like, you know, practically next door compared to Florida. At least it's like a little closer. They can drive there. But this next clip is her on the phone with her husband, just kind of like having a meltdown at the fact that she's going to see her family once a year. And anyone who has ever been in a long distance relationship, like this is the worst possible variation on the what's that supposed to mean fight that you always end up having in clip four.
If you feel that strongly about it, then I guess put in for a transfer. I mean,
don't feel that strongly about that feeling?
Well, no, I do. I mean, don't. Don't put words in my mouth, but I mean, I just...
I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how they're growing. You don't understand. And to not see them now at all? Are you kidding me? I couldn't even wrap my head around that. I could not do that.
I know.
Do you?
Yes, I know, Cindy.
I'm trying to be strong, and I just don't want to tell you guys everything, because I don't want you guys to be, you know, upset or worried or anything, but it's so hard.
Well, that's the thing, though. I want you to talk to me about it because I tell you about everything that I deal with that's hard. You know, I tell you about all of our hardships. I mean, we're a family, Cindy. You're my wife.
I'm okay, babe. Just trust me that I'm okay.
I mean, there's a point not long after this where you're told that they are getting divorced, and her husband Adam is just talking about how, you know, it's not that he doesn't love her, but the situation is impossible. And basically he kind of says that he would like to start shopping for another mother figure now before the girls get too old, which is like, oh, that's cold. But on the other hand, yeah, I guess that's practical, because he doesn't know what's gonna happen. Like, if she has to do the whole bid, because federal corrections, like, you don't, there's not like good time parole. You do the whole thing.
Right.
So, and then there's a scene where they're getting ready to make the trip to go see her, and he is sort of like fading out of the shot, like in Longtime Companion. It was really like eerie and just sad. Like, this, you just have no good choices if you're this family.
Right. I mean, I kind of, after the scene that you just played, like the divorce thing, was like the least surprising thing that happened in the entire documentary. It was because you could just tell that he was sort of emotionally divesting himself at that point.
Yeah.
It was sort of like, well, if that's what you want to do, and you can tell that she can tell too. It's like,
yeah.
What the fuck, dude? Like, you don't care if I do this or not? Like, you don't have any stake in this?
Yeah, and he's like, what he's thinking but clearly does not want to say or may have said enough times before is like, I have my hands completely full of caring right now, and I can't have this fight with you when there's nothing else that we can do. It really is, like, not to minimize it, but it really just is like the absolute worst of a long distance relationship with, like, none of the benefits. Oh, awful.
He's kind of an interesting character too, I thought, in that, you know, in some ways, like he's a freaking trooper. Like, he's got those three girls and he's just raising them, and I just can't even imagine what that's like, although he's got his in-laws and that family nearby and they can help him, but you can just see it's not what he signed up for, certainly. So in that way, but in other ways, like when she's when he's like, well, I tell you about all the struggles that we have, and I'm like, dude, what are you doing, man? She's in prison, you know. She's spending all this time telling you not to worry. Like, I don't think you laying like how hard it is to raise the kids that she can't be around while she's in prison. Like, I don't see that as being like particularly helpful. He's, you know, I don't know. He makes in some ways he like ends up being sort of a sort of strong, sort of forthright guy in that he, and she talks about this at the end, like I knew I could trust you with the girls and that they would have a family and blah, blah, blah. And that's, you know, that's all well and good. But he also, like, he feels he's more outwardly sorry for himself than I think I would be comfortable sort of exhibiting if I was in that situation. Like, even if you feel that way, it seems like you should kind of suck it up because you're not the one in prison. But I don't know if you picked up on that or maybe I'm off.
I didn't get a ton of self-pity from him. It did seem like this is a guy who maybe doesn't put names easily on feelings.
Yeah.
And like emotional desires. Like, he, that may not be a vocabulary that he has. And it's one that I think for a relationship to survive something like this, you have to develop a little more like explicit of a caretaking language. Like, sorry, I know that's sort of smurfy, but you know, I think that that's not, it's not necessarily helpful to just stuff everything, even though it might seem like it is. And I think you also have two people who are trying to be really strong for each other, and then they just end up not talking.
Right.
So, but you know, I assume that this was sort of an emotional negotiation that was had, and it, I don't know what the upshot was. Like, at the end, he's obviously still around. Like, you have the whole family gathered together, and you know, he's there.
Right. And they're all saying how much they love him and stuff.
Yeah, and they seem very close with him, and they don't seem to have any issues with how he's handled anything. So who knows what we saw that was off camera. And also, I'm sure that it was awkward for the director that he's like, well, I'm not going to push that aspect of it. Like, I think another documentarian who was not related,
right,
might have tried to get into that more, but who knows?
It's so weird that at the end, like, he's literally working on his car while he's talking to him.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, is it that he was so busy that he didn't have time to stop working on his car to talk to you? Or did you think that that would be like a natural situation in which it would be good to film him rather than like a talking head like he has been for most of the rest of it? That was a strange, I mean, there wasn't anything wrong with it, but it was,
well,
it
like
was
the
sort
rest
of
the
funny,
family is inside sort of, you know, all gathered together and eating flautas, and he's like, and it's raining, P.S., but he's still outside working on the car, and maybe he is just one of those guys who would rather, like, who is sort of fairly solitary, excuse the pun, and that the sensitive topic that he was talking about at the end, maybe Valdez thought, well, I'll just let him have some tools, and maybe that'll be a little bit easier.
Right.
And there's that parallel with Valdez, who's like, oh, well, this is a little easier for me to handle emotionally if I'm behind a camera making it into a story. So there's that parallel between the brothers-in-law. So, but yeah, it was kind of this law and order, like, I'm busy stacking racks of bread and can't stop and talk to you about this case. That, yeah, I didn't even actually notice that until you mentioned it. Our next clip is a guy named Eric Sterling, who is captioned here as a drug policy expert. He was actually the lead lawyer for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we're going to hear from / about him in the next segment as well. But it's interesting that he's talking about this with such rue when he, I think, authored a lot of the language that everyone is living with these sentencing minimums. Here's clip five.
The Congress referred to one of the major problems of the mandatory minimums that were enacted in 1986 as the girlfriend problem. They are treated as co-conspirators, and therefore they're fully liable under the sentencing guidelines for all the quantity of drugs that the conspiracy handled. And so many members of Congress referred to the need to fix what they called the girlfriend problem.
I mean, did they? Or are you just feeling guilty? Because these guidelines went into effect in like 1987.
Right.
So if they felt that strongly about it, they've had two decades of opportunities to reverse parts of it.
Well, it's hard to imagine like members of Congress talking somewhat sincerely about something they think is wrong and then doing nothing about it.
I know. I'm shocked, Toby.
Yeah. So my faith in the system took a severe blow.
It's really, really shaken to the core. But enough about your Southern Alabama district fandom.
Oh, God.
At least for now. Our final clip is a little bit of a spoiler, so you may want to skip ahead a couple of minutes. I mostly clipped it because the mom's response is just the most quintessentially American thing in the world. Here's clip six.
I'm coming home, Mama.
I know, baby girl. I can't wait to hold you, and you can just come and go, and we can go to the mall.
I just want to come and cuddle, Mama. I want to hug you.
And go to the mall.
Yeah. It'll be so much fun.
That's probably what I would do to be like, you won't believe the shit they have at the Old Navy now. Like, let's go.
We'll hit the Orange Julius and then we'll go to Old Navy.
Yeah. I mean, why not? And then you can have you can get a smartphone and then have the screen fixed. It'll be awesome. This movie is not perfect, but I think it is really I think it's about this family, and this family is so likable and relatable, and this problem is so intractable for them that I thought it was really affecting. It was a fine way to spend an hour and 23 minutes. And I think this filmmaker has got the goods. So yeah, I really liked it, and I would recommend it.
Yeah, for me, I've consumed over the past like 3+ years so much true crime, and this seemed to fill a spot that hadn't been sort of addressed yet, and it actually was interesting watching it like this particular week with Serial going on and having just listened to a Serial episode where they're some of the talk is about sentencing and about these plea bargains. And there's this crazy scene where these guys are like, you know, well, how about 10? No, it's gotta be 25. It's like, well, 15, can we cover? And I'm like, 50, you're like, these are like 5, 10, 15 years of somebody's life that you're just kind of like throwing numbers around and like, oh no, that, you know, and this shows what that is. You know, it's, you know, you can talk about numbers and you can have conversations about like, if it's not 25 years, you know, how are you honoring the victim and all this stuff. But it's like, it's a really long time, and B, the impact is greater than just that person. And you have to kind of think about sort of what's the purpose, because the purpose seems to me to be largely sort of vengeful rather than anything else.
And performative as well.
Yeah. And I think that'll come up in the second part.
Like, for whose benefit is that it just sort of reminded me of like Kavanaugh, like thundering away in his hearing and all the commentators being like, that was for an audience of one person. Like you just have to wonder how much of this is like for the C-SPAN cheap seats so that you can go back to your district and be like, I fought crime. Like,
And the whole thing is cool. is that, you know, 90% of what you were kind of talking about up until Kavanaugh is,
sorry,
you know, it's all the war on drugs.
Yeah.
Right. It's like the reason why public defenders have to walk that balance between, you know, generalizing and being too wound up in each individual case is there's so many freaking cases because it's nonviolent drug offenders that are being pushed through the system. And if you decriminalize that, then I think that the case will becomes more manageable and you're starting to deal with people who there's actually sort of a benefit to, you know, sitting to remediation or whatever, and that you can deal with the drug issues some other way. But just throwing everybody in jail or prison is not, you know, it's overwhelmed the system. I mean, I'm not, you know, that's not
well,
an original.
Well, and then you're also, yeah, as you're hearing on Serial, it also starts like once you have a charge on you, it just like so often it's snowballing. And you're just, you know, back there and back there and back there. And then you miss a court date because you can't get off work. And then you get fired because you have a court date. And then it just.
Right. And it's all, you know, it's all like, on poor people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the long and short of it is, yeah, I recommend it. It's absolutely not the kind of thing I normally watch, but it's really affecting. And I think it does. You know, it puts a human face on this idea of doing years and years in prison and what the impact of that is, what that actually looks like.
Agree. All right, moving along to our cold case, which will probably be a pretty short segment because we referred to it so many times in the first segment. We are contemplating This American Life, episode 143 from 1999. It is called Sentencing. I just Googled This American Life sentencing and that's what came up. And I was like, let's do this. So here's the case. And I had no idea that there would be this much overlap between not just the first property that we talked about, but the property that you, Toby, are thinking about every week for Crime Writers On. And then, you know, Courtroom 302, like, I just feel like I've been marinating in these problems for weeks now. Here's the case file. As with many This American Life episodes, it's actually several case files. Another instance of the girlfriend problem. Eric Sterling, who we heard earlier talking about said girlfriend problem, who was the lead lawyer for the Senate Judiciary Committee in the mid-80s, and I believe a lead author of this spasm of self-righteous response to the crack epidemic, and the Serial Season 3/Courtroom 302-esque segment that spends an evening in Chicago's drug night court. I thought this was it's This American Life. It's good. There's like a baseline of quality. It's well built. I thought it might be a little like cutesy, like that Moby track that played in the middle just brought me straight back to this time in my life where that literally was in every East Village coffee shop that was playing. And I was like, oh God, this really is like an old piece of work. And yet it feels like no progress has been made. Here is clip 7.
Federal drug enforcement also tends to disproportionately prosecute minorities. They made up 73% of federal drug convictions in 1998, even though 72% of illegal drug use is by white people. And federal penalties are much more severe for crack cocaine than for other drugs. This is reporter Sam Hodges, who first wrote about Dorothy's case in the Alabama Mobile Register.
It's just clear that a very high percentage, an extremely high percentage of those who are convicted for crack, which carries the longest sentences of all, are black people. And if you're in a federal judicial district where crack is the focus, as it has been in South Alabama, and a lot of crack cases end up in federal court as opposed to state court, then you're really up against it. I mean, your odds of ending up with one of these very long no parole sentences go up pretty dramatically. And I think that's the environment in which Dorothy Gaines was caught up.
Well, it's really cool to see how much progress we've made.
You could seriously drop that today and just change like a few things and nobody would know the difference.
Yeah.
I don't know what other clips you've got lined up, but there's a point at which Mike Hood, who's the Chicago prosecutor, is being asked about that, you know, basically the same thing that Ira Glass was just talking about then, which is, you know, if these are the stats about actual drug use, why is everybody who's coming through your court or why are all these people who you're prosecuting, why are they all black? And he's like, said something about, oh, I don't see color. I just see a guy who, it's like, dude, you know, A, bullshit, and B, this might be a good time to look and see color because it should be telling you something, you know?
Exactly. Like, how about you start? Because it's relevant.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's so, this is like, we never talk about politics on Crime Writers, but it's so disingenuous, these arguments that are made to say we're not targeting minorities and particularly African Americans. I mean, it's just, it's such bullshit. And you know, and then I think it was on this, right, where they're talking about they're trying to get some senators to talk about these sentencing things, and nobody would. And it was like Jeff Sessions.
Yes.
Like, fuck that guy. Mike That's DeWine, right. Who was the worst, who was a senator from Ohio.
Orrin Hatch.
Orrin Hatch, like pencil neck Orrin Hatch. And there was some other guy. So I was working at Congressional Quarterly, like right after this, you know. So I'm familiar with all these guys. I was like, it's the same fucking guys who are speaking with forked tongues, who are just, you know, it's clear what's happening, and it keeps being met with, oh, I don't see color, you know, I just see criminals. It's like, well, then why do you get sentenced for 10 times as much for the same amount of crack as powder cocaine? Like,
yeah,
that's
because
simply
white people
to incarcerate
use powder cocaine.
People.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and once it's been pointed out to you, you don't get to be like, it's a coincidence. Like,
right.
When you had to open a like drug night court to handle your drug caseload, that's not coincidence. That's fucked up is what it is. But I, you know, pretending that institutional bias does not exist is not going to help any aspect of this problem that you claim to want to solve.
Right.
But, Well, here's a clip from Eric Sterling. Again, we heard from him before about the attractiveness of rhetoric and being able to say you did something, even if that something is draconian. Here's clip 8.
I mean, do people turn to each other and just say, this is, you know, what are we doing?
No, not in this case. There's a way in which rhetoric crowds out rationality. If you're a member of Congress and you've spent a lot of time dealing with the minutiae of various arcane federal programs, it's not simply a breath of fresh air. It's really intoxicating to talk about the issue of drugs with its good versus evil clarity. I mean, you can, it's like you can loosen up your tie, you can start pounding the table, and you know you can connect with your constituents when you start talking about the scourge of drugs, the menace of drugs, the danger that our children face, the epidemic, the pandemic.
You're saying in a way that anti-drug rhetoric is like a drug.
Yes, that's right.
Thanks, Ira. I mean,
yikes. Like, yeah, and then Eric Sterling quotes Barney Frank as saying that, like, anti-drug rhetoric is the crack cocaine of political discourse or something like that. If listeners, if you decide to check this out, like, it is a full hour. If you feel like you only have time for one segment, I would go with this one, which is Act Two. And there's also a transcript if you just want to read it, and I'll link to that in the show notes. Yeah, that was, I feel like this Sterling guy is maybe like trying to work off what he sees as his role in this. I don't actually know what his day job is, but I think he was just like, another thing he says is that I think he wrote these guidelines and he thought that they would be like fact checked or sent to committee.
Right.
And that like judges would weigh in, the marshals would weigh in, prison wardens would weigh in. And none of that happened. They just like signed it into law. And he was like, okay.
Right. Well, I think that's almost standard operating procedure these days. But back then it was, you know, the thought was that people would give it a little bit of thought. I
think there was also Len Bias had just died.
Right.
And, you know, for listeners who are not that old and don't remember that, like, that was like a sort of seismic cultural event in terms of, like, how we thought about drugs. And I think that a lot of, you know, senators came back for that session and were just screaming in Tip O'Neill's face, like, we have to look like we're doing something. But that's what it comes down to. Like, we have to look like we're doing something. Like, all right, well, maybe start with the NCAA then if you really want to tackle a problem.
It's just like Orrin Hatch and Jeff Sessions. Like, really? You guys are guys who are like going to have like some sort of objective view on the scourge of drugs.
Yeah, but you know, I think hobgoblins that have checked in.
Exactly. So I think my two reactions are one, it's that is like you've got these like they were geriatric even back then, like wealthy, like somewhat racist white guys making decisions about this stuff. And then the other thing is, I mean, there's something in the American psyche that is just absolutely unforgiving and vengeful. Particularly when it comes to locking up minorities, I would say. And so you would think in like a rational society, like this, like being just insanely tough on crime and giving these absolutely draconian sentences to people who have tiny little bits to do with actual drug deals, like people would be like, whoa, that's like, that's a little out of hand that, you know, if you happen to be the girlfriend of a guy who's dealing a lot of drugs, like you can go away for 20 years. Like that seems like unreasonable, but in fact that sells. And people are afraid of like being critical of that and saying like, whoa, hold on a second. And that I think is like not a real great look for the US, quite honestly.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could sort of bundle this in with that we still have the death penalty.
Oh yeah.
Which like what kind of civilized society? Like are we caning people for spitting out their gum on the streets? Not yet, but you know, it could happen.
But like in Norway, that guy Anders Breivik, who killed 77 people, like his jail sentence was 21 years.
Yeah.
Right. And it doesn't mean he's getting out after 21 years because they've got this whole thing where they can reevaluate. But, you know, in Norway, it was like 21 years. Like that is for the most serious crime. Like that is the biggest sentence we're going to give to somebody. And here it's like you make a phone call to your cousin to help arrange a drug deal and you could be doing like 50.
Yeah.
It's insanity.
And on top of that, I mean, I think other societies are much more interested in actual rehabilitation. of criminals and view that as a priority. Like, okay, you have 21 years. Let's see if we can get you a master's and straighten out your medications. But there's also something about the, at least in terms of drug policy, the American punishment model that is allergic to the idea that this is a disease. And that at a certain point, like, it is not productive to address an illness, like to the illness of addiction, with punishment. Like, you know, there's chemicals and then there's behavior. And I don't know. I just find it depressing and frustrating. Like, if you're operating a motor vehicle while you're nodding out or you're drunk, fine. Do some time. That's okay. But that should be paired with something that's going to get a different result the next time.
Right.
And it never is. And I will say that this was one of the few properties about drug policy and drug law and crime and punishment, including Intervention, which sadly I've seen every episode of, that gave me any sort of realistic idea what possession amounts actually mean. Here's our last clip.
Here's a typical case. Tony Bell was a skinny 27-year-old black man who kept rubbing his head with his hands. He stood in front of the judge with his back to me and was charged with possession of 0.2 grams of crack. Think of a Sweet and Low packet. That's a gram. 0.2 of that.
What?
Yeah.
Like, is this a great use of anyone's time? Like, Tony Bell's over it, I'm sure. He is in the night court they had to open because of the sheer volume of bullshit. Like, yellow sheets like this. The cops are going to have to come and testify. The judge has to deal with it. He has to be assigned a public defender. So all of this, like, all of this effort is put forth for what was probably like a fingernail-sized shaving of rock cocaine.
Like, it's,
and
like,
then none of that is spent being like, here's an NA meeting, we picked you out a sponsor, or like, here's a detox.
It's so little. Like, that's the kind of, like, if it was some other substance that wasn't so expensive, like if you're emptying out like a baggie that had cinnamon in it or something, like, yeah, that would be as much that was like left over that you would just throw out the baggie with, because you'd be like, oh, I got it all. I mean, it's just, yeah, nothing.
And if it were powder cocaine and it belonged to Topher Bell.
Yeah. The drug war. And then, and there's also, I mean, it's of a piece with like these traffic stops they do. And I think the focus has really been around St. Louis and the coverage I've seen, where you're trying to raise money to run your municipality through traffic tickets. And it's like all these things are basically focused on the poor in society, and who are the people who can least sort of accommodate those issues into their lives. It's more devastating. So it's really, there's another thing, and I know I mentioned to you on an email, there's a Frontline called Snitch that talks, is a similar thing. And it also, one of the two or three storylines takes place in the Southern District of Alabama, and involves, you know, another situation where somebody is, you know, facing incredible amounts of time for almost nothing.
Alabama, the second worst place in the United States to find yourself caught up in a miscarriage of justice. The worst place? Mississippi.
Right. And Alabama's also the home state of our attorney general at the moment. Go figure.
Here's another, like, sort of interesting thing about how timely this still is, that I think now you're talking about trace amounts of like a ground up Vicodin, or like, it's totally shifted epidemic wise from crack to opioids. But they're still using the same, quote, tools to, quote, fight the war on drugs, even though the opioid crisis, it's just setting off a bomb in families, like all over the country, like just wiping out like whole generations. Like you have a ton of on Cape Cod, huge problem, like tons of grandparents raising their grandkids because their kids died. And I don't see how sentencing and test a lying about traffic stops where you claimed you smelled marijuana, like that's not working. You have to do something else. You have to.
And the thing is that the number one, you know, entity that was responsible for the opioid thing is this Purdue Pharmaceutical, mm-hmm. and it's clear and it's documented and. You know.
There's a New Yorker article about it, and I'll put that in the show notes. Yeah, I wanted to scream and kick someone.
Yeah, you just want to. And there's something else that somebody actually tweeted to me that they're like, "Oh, have you checked this out about Purdue Pharma?" And I was like, "Oh God." but they, yeah. I mean, they knew about this, and nothing's going to happen to them.
No.
You know, where some street level person. I mean, you're talking about. Like that's the origin of this whole thing is that one company selling OxyContin to begin with, and then like a variety of other things with like minor changes so that they could continue to charge their exorbitant prices, and that's what started the whole thing. It was this one place, and you know, are they going to be held accountable? Of course not.
No.
So
there will be a class action suit. There'll be a damage award of $1.
Right. And those guys and all those, you know, their entire board should be, you know, if there was, you
shamed,
know,
yeah, publicly shamed.
Well, they should be in jail for, you know, however long, 20, 30 years, like whatever you're going to give a drug kingpin for things like they've done everything that drug kingpins do. Yeah. Except that it was legal largely because they were lying about what they knew about it. So anyway.
And they made even more money.
Made
money for their investors. America.
Well, that's what counts.
We're doing great. Great job, America.
Keep those investors happy.
Oh, God. Speaking of keeping people happy, where else can listeners find you and what you're up to and thinking about?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at TobyBallNH. You can find me at the Crime Writers On podcast. And we have a Patreon podcast, which Sarah's been on several times, called Ball's Deep Dive. And it's, you know, it's a book discussion podcast.
Indeed. Picnicking Friends, you should really check out my latest episode, which was about the Monster of Florence. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Eve Beatty is back to talk about Making a Murderer Part 2. After that, Mike Dunn will return for History's Watergate event, and Stephanie Green will discuss Dr. Death and Gypsy's Revenge. Jonestown, Dirty John, it's going to be a busy fall. Do you have a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. And you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. And if you don't like the podcast, keep it to yourself, won't you? My guest has been Toby Ball. He's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.